get started. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. The last inclination of the year, number 17. And tonight I'm very, very happy to have Federica White, a dear friend, with whom I share many productive disagreements. But one thing we share in common, which I'm very excited to hear you talk about tonight, is a kind of commitment to affirmation practice. You may know Federica from some of her events that she held formerly at Archive Books before moving part-time to Oslo, so kind of jumping between Oslo and Berlin. She's also the founder of the journal Ment, as well has written for several publications, including Freeze DE, what else do you got here, Art Agenda, Extra. So she's currently a PhD candidate in critical writing in art design at the Royal College of Art in London. So without further ado, I'll give you the floor, and again, very happy to have you, and look forward to hearing your talk tonight. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Patricia, for the invitation. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Tonight, we are going to talk about, Karen Barat, but actually, I think what I want to do is more kind of a close reading of Karen Barat, and let's think about this talk as an exercise, more an exercise in kind of mapping resonances. So I'm not going to develop an argument. I don't have an argument for or against Karen Barat. I'm just kind of in the process of understanding what her ideas and thoughts are. So it's more a way that I feel like this talk is more a way of sharing something with you and maybe kind of thinking through these ideas together. Why Karen Barat? Because I find very, very interesting the way Karen Barat brings together feminist theory, science, physics, quantum theory, together with kind of political theory and Judith Butler, and she reads all these different positions through one another, which I find very, very, very interesting, very productive, and what she proposes a very, very dynamic system of thinking kind of process of materialization, thinking about ontology, thinking about epistemology, and especially thinking about ethics. I think Barat's writing is relatively easy. Her style is very kind of plain, kind of American academic kind of writing. But there is something that reminds me a lot of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, because I think they invented the language, and Karen Barat somehow also did it. So sometimes I think it's not so easy to get into the reading. It's not so easy to really understand, because you have to first understand particular concepts, specific concepts like agential realism, entanglement, and when she used this, all these terms in her writing, you really have to have a clear idea. And so that's why I feel like it's very, very difficult, and that's why I want to share it with you. I want to do a reading to see what we can kind of, what we can understand of Barat's theory of agential realism. Please, I'm going to read, but please feel free to stop me at any time. Just if you don't understand a word or you don't understand a concept or something, just stop me and I will try to explain. It would be nice if then you intervene and then we can have a conversation and maybe talk a little bit more about some of the issues that I'm kind of trying to kind of tackle today, tonight. And I would like to begin with a question that is a question important to me, and it's the question of what is an affirmative practice. Synonymous with naivety, lack of critical thinking, there seems to be much confusion about this concept. What does it mean to practice affirmation? Last summer, I attended a summer school entitled Critical Theory Beyond Negativity, the Ethics, Politics, and Aesthetics of Affirmation, led by a feminist thinker, philosopher, Rosie Bradotti, who also introduced me to this idea of affirmative practices. In preparation for this talk, I read through my notes and found this passage that says, affirmative is the practice of that transforms negative forces into positive energies. So a practice that transforms negative forces into positive energies. I think it might sound a little bit hippie-ish, but actually, I think it's a possible way of reading Spinoza's idea of endurance, which is to last, durare in Latin, which draws a great often links to the idea of sustainability. Making your practice affirmative is to make it sustainable. And to also make a practice affirmative is kind of create, make it sustainable, and make it kind of also, in a way, making possible changes so that changes can be sustained through an affirmative practice. An affirmative practice of thinking criticality as creative that strives to create empowering alternatives that resonates with the idea of philosophy as a form of creation, of intervention into the world. Affirmative is above all an embodied and embedded practice. Affirmative practices are practices of reworking and thinking in relational terms. These two ideas, reworking and relational, describe particular practices and discourses with a feminist genealogy. And I must say I'm in debt, enormously in debt, to feminist practices of affirmation, and to Rosie Gregotti, among others, for kind of my understanding of affirmative practices. Now, to rework seems to suggest a continuity with a set of existing conditions. But definitely it is more than that. The way reworking is used by Rosie Gradotti and other thinkers, including Karen Barad, means a practice of keeping certain politics alive, while of course allowing them to change, to transform, to become. So it's kind of this idea of keeping politics alive. That doesn't mean that you keep kind of reiterating the same idea, but you keep them alive so that they can change, they can transform and become something else. Reworking, then, is not an additive or cumulative, but a metabolic process. It's not a reiteration of the existing, as I said, but a production of differences. Reworking, as described by writer Kathy Ecker, is a way to break free from the patriarchal meaning-making myth. So, more than an act of resistance, what kind of politics do affirmative practices of reworking keep alive, then? I would argue, politics of sexual difference, of embodiment, situatedness. Feminist politics that are today threatened to be overshadowed by apocalyptic thinking, forms of nihilism. And from a world of positions within the field of social sciences, in which everybody seems to have an answer to everything, to know how the world works with or without human beings, or theory that propose thinking thoughts that think itself, and so on and so forth. Physicist and feminist philosopher of science Karen Barad describes her practice as an attempt to rework the notion of materiality, discursive practices, agency, performativity, apparatus, among others. Crucial to Barad's affirmative practice of reworking is the idea of entanglement. The understanding of the entangled nature of matter and meanings. Entanglement is Karen Barad's key term to describe how reality comes to matter. To be entangled, she suggests, is not simply to be intertwined with another, as in the joining of separate entities, but to lack an independent, self-contained existence. individuals emerge through and as a part of the entangled interrelating. So entanglement not only entails that we consider the world in relation of like entity in relation, but that we understand our connection and responsibility to one another. So for Bharat, entanglement is a way to say we are responsible, we are dependent from one another. We are not separate entities that from time to time come together and relate to one another, but we are dependent. We human beings, we rocks, we nature, we environment, we are interdependent. To understand the entangled nature of reality is to acknowledge a certain degree of inseparability between seemingly distinct entities, phenomena, or ideas. It is also a way of overcoming binaries and separations between, for instance, words and things, nature and culture, subject and object, observer and observed. What Bharat is developing in this way, thinking through kind of the relationality, thinking that we are in this, the process of mattering is a process of kind of entanglement, where we become into being, where the world materialize through this moment of what she called interacting, just this kind of coming together. We shape each other. So there are no pre-existing entities, basically. So what she is kind of trying to develop with this idea of entanglement is, first of all, like a different starting point, a different ontology, which is a relational ontology. So where things are not separated. And I think what I found incredibly interesting in Karen Bharat is that she's a thinker who thinks through complexity. But work through complexity without necessarily kind of trying to reduce complexity to simple things to make it more clear. No, she really worked through complexity to show how complexity is possible to think complexity without reducing it to some kind of simple kind of units of things or simple statements. So what Bharat is developing, as I say, is a relational ontology that she describes with the term agential realism, where agential is, Bharat observes, an enactment, not something that someone or something has, but a doing. It is what you say, is a cutting together and apart. So agency is not something that we own, that we possess, but it's a doing, it's a practice. So she says, well, agency doesn't belong to human being, but agency is everywhere, because it's this process, it's a practice, it's a doing, it's a process of kind of becoming, of materializing. I will explain that in realism later. But right now you have the attention. It is important to note that Bharat's relational ontology sets a different set of conditions to begin with. For instance, as we say, as we've seen, that there are not separate entities that in some way relate to one another, but there are phenomena that come into being through relations, or what she called through intra-activity. Agential realism does not rely on reflection as a key method of analysis. Rather, Bharat's method is performative. What do I mean with performative? In one example is like the way she reads insights from feminist theory, post-structuralist philosophy, from Derrida, Foucault, Judith Butler, quantum theory, classic physics, through one another, which makes it very, 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 very interesting. Because it's not just putting one next to the other, and so, okay, I know this, I know that. And then we have transdisciplinarity. You know, she really works with different insights coming from different disciplines and kind of trying to read them through one another. And I feel like in her book, Meeting the Universe, Alpha Way, there is a kind of an interesting chapter on the idea of the concept of, let's say, reworking the idea of the apparatus, in which she reads Foucault and Bohr, Niels Bohr, ideas of the apparatus through one another. So she brings together more Foucauldian, so it's kind of discursive idea, and where she says Foucault, in a way, failed to account for the materiality of reality and focus more on the discursive, and then she in a way, supplements Foucault's idea of the apparatus with Niels Bohr's idea of the apparatus as a scientific apparatus as materialization of concepts. So she worked them together. And this is performative in her words. Barat's idea of the entangled nature of meaning and matter resonates strongly with contemporary artistic practices, with those practices that use discourses as a material, an object as a discursive tools for artistic inquiry. Artistic practices that, in one way or another, address the relation between the material and the discursive. Barat's relation on ontology, and then we will see, I have some examples of artistic practices that I feel like they, in a way, like make a lot of Barat concept clearer somehow, because there are artists that work with complexity, with language, with material, that thinks the relation between language and material, and I think they're a beautiful example of like what Barat, in a way, kind of is trying to think through. Barat's relational ontology and her reworking of question of matter, discursive practices, agency, causality, offers us a way of thinking that does not have to choose between either to focus on theory and discourses or on practice kind of and more making, either join the league of research-based type of artistic practices or the more, let's say, sensual, poetic practices. One does not have to choose between objectivity and subjectivity in Barat's kind of understanding of agential real, of how reality works, or choose between the universal or the particular, between carbon-based life forms of the life of the algorithm, between the analytical rigor of science and the messiness of artistic practices. To explain her idea of the relational, entangled nature of how matter materializes, Barat points to the way in which, according to quantum physics, materialities are queer events. Queer events, we could also say that they are events of difference, where basically this idea of entanglement and non-entanglement separation are part of the same event, of the same phenomenon. So it's queer, it doesn't necessarily have a clear identity. Queer materialities, where queer, Barat suggests, is not only strangeness, it is the undoing of identities. And queer does not necessarily refer to the exceptional, but Barat seems to suggest that queer materialities, they can be like just normal events, like totally ordinary materialization of phenomena. Like, for instance, light. The materiality of light could be understood as a queer materiality. And Karen Barat explains, this is one of her examples of queer materialities. There are more examples, all derived from physics, but this, I think, is the simplest and quite strong. For a long time, physicists have been busy trying to understand whether light is made of particles or of waves. Quantum theory, Barat says, reached the conclusion that light is composed of particles with wave-like properties. So depending on the occasion, light, the light behaves as a particle or as a wave. Maybe you want to ask bioluminescent submarines, living organism, about queer materialities and what they think about it. For example, the Dinoflagellates, a particular species of plankton, is a whitish here, releases energy as light emissions, which leave a trail of greenish-blue light when touched or stimulated by the water flow. Or you can also ask about light to the medusa there. It's called Aquaria medusa. The luminescent light produced by the Aquaria, which is bluish in color, is attributable to a molecule known as aquarine. Or again, you can ask the scorpion, whose body glows when exposed to ultraviolet light. You could ask them, what is the nature of light? Is it a particle? Is it a wave? Or is it my body? Probably the scorpion would say, it's my body. Or isn't light touch, perhaps? As they glow, as this bioluminescent organism glow when touched, whether by light, by other organism, by our hands dipping in water. I was introduced to bioluminescent submarine organism by artist Susanne Winterling, who is currently working on a long-term research project in San Juan, Puerto Rico, that takes as a starting point the observation of bioluminescent organism. This is Susanne's work. This is part of an installation called Ecologist. And then it's a video, it's Scorpio, and it's basically 3 minutes, more or less, something like that, of kind of just the camera observing the Scorpio, which is in this laboratory, and I'm just watching what he's doing, observing his behavior. I mean, Susanne made a series of installations, videos, photos, sound pieces, and also talks, a screening. It's a very complex project to work through the question of materialization, to understand and work through this idea of how matter comes to matter. What is the entangled nature of kind of meaning and in matter? And how art can meaningfully contribute to this discussion. Bioluminescent organism feel like beautifully embody the entangled nature of meaning and matter. But although bioluminescence is a visual, perceptual phenomenon, it is touch that make it even perceivable. So I feel with this kind of bioluminescent organism, they are a very beautiful example of this kind of entangled nature of reality, where it's one materialization is many things at the same time. So yes, bioluminescent is a visual kind of phenomenon, but it passed through touch, and so touch is also part of this kind of, even the possibility of this, of the materialization of this phenomenon. Indeed, many of these living organisms are touch sensitive. The sea cucumber that you see here glows when touched. I look up on the internet and I found out the light production in the sea cucumber is triggered mechanically and is produced by hundreds of granular bodies. So local stimulation yields a localized response which gradually spreads to the entire surface of the animal. The degree of luminous response is also a function of the contact, of the severity of the contact. In the dark, near bottom habitat, physical contact by a predator elicits light production, which reveals the presence of the attacker to its own visually cued predators. touched, being touched. This is the kind of ecology that Susanna is evoking in her work. A being, a becoming through touch, through immersion, contact, attunement, feeling, contagion, affection, entanglement, remembering. These are figuration at play in Susanna Winterling's work. The video still that you see, that show this close-up of her hands suspended in what looked like seawater or some kind of liquid, with her thumbs rolling, the hands touch each other's skin, but they are also touched by what looked like, the spike of a sea urchin, which had become like a second skin, in a motion that has no beginning, no end. This image, I think it's a beautiful description of Susanna's relation to art. Art is a form of touching. But more in general, touch as this kind of generative moment through the experience of which our old reality materializes. And touch is also about what touches us. It is an ethical matter. Touching is feeling for the other, feeling touched by something, touching. Touching is also a form of being, becoming entangled. By touching one, we touch all others. Physics, as Karen Barad says, is also about touching. Electrons move and make leaps when touched. They get excited. There is a beautiful description in Karen Barad's book, Meeting the Universe of the Way, of what she called, what is called a quantum leap. And apparently when an atom is stimulated, inside the electrons start kind of moving from one energy level to the other. And in this kind of movement, which apparently has no trajectory, as no, you cannot really understand what kind of movement, because suddenly the electron is at one point, at one energy level, and then suddenly in a different energy level. But apparently this kind of moment of kind of this leap, the electrons produces a photon, which doesn't exist. That there is no way that you can say that you can see the photon. It's just a possibility. But this is what quantum physics say, quantum theory say, when an electron's jump make this jump, they produce, they emit a photon. So Barad, in one of her texts on touching, Barad described this kind of touching, this kind of feeling of the electron that really gets excited. In her essay on touching, the inhuman that the 4M, which is an homage to Jacques Derrida, as the title suggests, Karen Barad suggests that theorists are living and breathing reconfigurings of the world. She said the world theorizes, as well as experiments with itself, figuring, reconfiguring. Animate and so-called inanimate creatures do not merely embody mathematical theories, Karen Barad say, they do mathematics. But life, whether organic or inorganic, inanimate or animate, is not an unfolding algorithm. Barad says, electrons, molecules, brittle stars, jellyfish, coral reefs, dogs, frogs, icebergs, plants, asteroids, snowflakes, and bees stray from all calculable path, making leaps here and there, or rather, making here and there from leaps, shifting pattern practices, testing the water of what might yet be, have been, could still have been, doing thought experiments with their very being. So the scorpion in the laboratory glows when its skin is touched by this black light, and also when Susanne touches it with the eye of the camera, almost giving this scorpion, this animal, another skin. Now all this bioluminescent organism glow under particular conditions. So they, according to the situation, also they glow in a different manner. So let's say that touch is touching, touch is becoming, touch is transformation, but touch is also this moment of interference. When you touch something, something else happening, you are interfering with life. Also in the case of the bioluminescent organism, they often start glowing when they are touched by, I don't know, when they feel danger coming. And also they glow, as the case of the scorpion, in particular kind of condition, laboratory conditions, which brings me to Barat's explanation of the nature of the entanglement as linked to a particular understanding of the apparatus. And she refers to Bohr, Niels Bohr, idea of the apparatus, but also idea of the phenomena. In Bohr, consideration of the nature of the phenomena. Bohr understood phenomena as inseparable from their interaction with the scientific apparatus, which in this case, in the case of Bohr, also includes it's not only the apparatus, the technical apparatus, but it's also the observer, the researcher. Bohr described the measuring apparatus as a productive, and here I'm quoting, productive of and part of the phenomenon produced. He explained that any attempt to open or cut through a phenomenon will inevitably produce a new phenomenon. So each separation produces a new phenomenon. So there is no way that you can analyze something without kind of being part of that phenomenon, but also the moment that you change, that you want to isolate a phenomenon or look at a particular aspect of that phenomenon, you are already producing another phenomenon. You are already using another idea, a new idea. You are bringing something, you are using a different instrument, and basically you are producing a new phenomenon because you are kind of reconfiguring the configuration, basically. This is why there is no phenomenon prior to the moment of its materialization that is its interacting. For example, again, the bioluminescence of suffering living organism will only appear in the moment of its happening. It's not something that you can, you have to produce that, you have to stimulate. Bioluminescence doesn't exist or doesn't appear before we trigger it. Which is quite interesting because if you follow me, then this would mean that basically only things come to existence only the moment that they materialize. Which is a little bit weird. But then Barat explains something about this process of materialization. And she says something about like what we should also think about and what is left outside this process of materialization, which is death. So in the moment of materialization, something is left outside. But we should also consider that outside, because that outside has implications in the materialization of reality. To go back to Bohr's idea of the phenomena, so Paul says, okay, phenomena do not pre-exist the moment of their analysis, they don't pre-exist the moment in we point a lens and like look at a particular object, particular animal, particular thing that we are kind of trying to investigate. But again, as Paul suggested, each and every element, including ourselves, are part of the materialization of a phenomenon. That phenomena do not pre-exist the moment of manifesting does not mean that what doesn't materialize doesn't exist. Karen Barad observed that each meeting matters, not just for what comes to matter, but what is constitutively excluded from it, excluded from mattering, in order for particular materialization to occur. Which has a very, very interesting implication, I think, because then Barad describes the phenomenon and discursive practices as boundary-making practices. So that create boundaries, create contours, and left something outside. And she said, okay, we should ask ourselves, what is that left outside, and how do phenomena and discursive practices, how do they function, why do they, kind of, what kind of boundaries are they kind of enacting? By following Bohr, Barad concludes that phenomena and not things are primary ontological unit. So, phenomena and not things are primary ontological unit. In this sense, we are talking about a relational ontology in which it is not bits and pieces of phenomena, what we call things, but phenomena in their complexity, when bits and pieces are already entangled, that constitute the primary units of ontological investigation. So as we saw before, we have seen before about entanglement. So there are no things, there are no single entity that we can retrace. Karambara say there is no beginning, forget about beginning. It's this kind of this continuous motion, this kind of very dynamic system, where it is always where we talk, where the primary units are phenomena, which are already entanglement.
Is it like that, sorry?
Yeah.
It's not about chickens or eggs, it's about laying.
Sorry? Is it not about chickens or eggs?
It's not about chickens or eggs, it's about laying. The laying the egg is phenomena.
Yeah. You can say so. That's not, yeah. Why not? And I like this idea of entanglement because it really like it allows us to really think in terms of kind of really of motion rather than having kind of fixed identities that you just move around. A heated room, a small room, a room filled with warm air and many people inside. A room filled with people and warm air together with the word entanglement. What do you think? It will prompt a particular kind of thought and feelings, which might be different from if I would pronounce entangled or entanglement in a big empty room, then it would feel kind of very remote. It would look blue, spherical, and cold. And if I say entanglement or involvement or affair or corruption, they would sound very different to your ears. They will prompt different thoughts and also different responses. And it's because the meanings of words are always already entangled into cultures and histories, into existing discursive practices. So Barrage, also in the case of words, suggests that words, we shouldn't be thinking about words as a primary ontological unit, but discursive practices are the basic unit, ontological unit. What she called material discursive practices. So ontological units, we said, are phenomena and discourses, not things and words. Now, each phenomenon and each discursive practice are entangled and are themselves entanglements. That in this process, as we say, as we see, of materialization, always exclude something. This is because entanglements and agency, like phenomena and apparatus, are not things, but doing. So the idea of the discursive practices is a doing. Phenomena are doings. They are not things. As agency is not a thing that we own, but is a doing, a practice. And metta is this intra-activity, is this process of mattering, of kind of becoming. But discourses, Karen Barrage argues, are not material in the sense that they substantialize body or that they possess some magic material qualities. In Karen Barrage's posthumanist account, neither do materials support discourses, like would be, let's say, the case in Judy Butler, nor do discourses support material. But discourses are material in the sense that they are implicated in the reconfiguration of the world through which boundaries and meanings are differentially enacted. And material is always already material discourses. So phenomena and discourses are what Barrage calls boundaries-making practices that, she says, perform a cut that gives meaning to certain concepts to the exclusion of others, through which what is human and what is non-human are differentially delineated and defined. In this sense, meaning is not a property of an individual. It's not the property of words, of group of words, but is an ongoing performance of the word.
Excuse me. You gave Judith Butler as an example of material supporting discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give an example of discourse supporting material? Something like Foucault or something?
Yeah. Discourses supporting material, yeah. That's, I don't think I can give you an example now. But
okay.
Does anybody
no.
have an example?
Well, maybe just like scientific definition, you know. The characteristics of the material, maybe?
Maybe it's structuralist anthropology as opposed to the structural binaries that prior to any kind of cultural phenomenon. Those are almost intact in their platonic transcendence.
Can you say that again?
Carl Schmitt would probably say nomos in the context that you have the nomadic formula for the composition of territoriality. And in that sense, it's that discourse of constitution of composition that would indicate the materiality of Knowsbury.
And it stays building.
Yeah.
Everything's building construction. And the question would be then, what would you be supporting? Is it defining or is it, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think in general, what Bharat is trying to say is that, okay, there is, like, I don't know, for instance, with Judith Butler example, she says, okay, Judith Butler wants to account for our kind of bodies matter, okay, all like this, like the materiality of bodies come from matter, and our kind of bodies are produced, like it is almost the true kind of discursive practices. But then what happened was, at least in Bharat understanding, what happened with Judith Butler is that Judith Butler then looked at the, put too much emphasis, let's say, on the discursive side, as if the discursive would, like, create a body and leave some part of the materiality of the body, of the matter of the body, like, outside. And consider just it gets into this kind of idea of performativity and performance of meaning and of gender, which is very, very discursive. So I can imagine that on the then the same thing happened when they were on the other side, where there is a strong emphasis on the materiality against the discursive. I think what Bharat is trying to do is to balance this, to say, no, we need both. And both they both matter. Because you cannot think the material without the discursive, you cannot think the discursive without the material. So any emphasis on one or the other would miss the point. Sorry.
I think in Eastern philosophy, it would be Hume and Marx, the materialist, always as a critique of the content.
Yeah.
Or you would have, like, neuroscience explaining all of our behavior in terms of electrons or moving through neural pathways, or the chemical analysis explaining all of our behavior, or evolutionary biology explaining everything that we do. This is the material explaining. It's the opposite.
Yeah. All this theory, there are, like, let's say, these features of, like, language, of discourse.
But if we're going to get into the history of philosophy, dare I ask what sort of affirmation Murad is giving, considering, like, compared to, like, Whitehead or Dewey or William James, Isabel Stengers, all these people that are dealing with precisely the same material.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, what's affirming? Because, like, this sort of entanglement has been talked about for over 100 years.
Yeah.
So, well, what can we get from Bharat's specific reading of this?
That's a good question, obviously.
There's a lot of debts to, like, Foucault and Butler. There's a whole history of people that have dealt with this.
The very, very interesting thing about Bharat is that she's also mapping resonances. The same way I'm trying to do it in my own field, bringing kind of example from artistic practices. Bharat is mapping. It's not necessary. She's bringing different. I mean, she's not necessarily going against or trying to bring an entirely new perspective, but to just bring all these things together and read one through the other, so that post-structuralism can also read through quantum theory. So in a way, it's saying, okay, you know, it's not that the post-structuralism, she's trying to bring basically humanities and science together and show how close these two realms have always been.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that mean something that you were also pointing out about the queer materialities, which I guess is a new concept? No?
Affirmation is connected
with the non-identitarian, that what is affirmed is not just an identity of something, but something that is many things at the same time.
I think, like, for me, what I found very, very interesting in Bharat as an affirmative thinker is the idea that you work you work through things and you bring them together, offering a new perspective, a new reading. That's why I started talking about reworking, because reworking is precisely what Farad is doing, is that kind of going through an existing, not in a way that would put her in this position of the analyst who is constantly has to go back to the very beginning of a theory and explain from there, and then they're like never reaching any kind of more kind of propositive kind of, you
I'm
know,
not asking
perspective.
For that, but what I'm saying is this metaphysics
yeah.
that you seem to be describing
yeah.
has been affirmed and really like
yeah.
made solid for a long time.
Yeah.
And what issue from it? I hear about those queer materialities, I'm probing, you know, asking
yeah.
what sort of novelty is she generating?
Or we're not done
talking.
But
I know. I'm curious. Because it is discursive, because you are talking about Foucault, you are talking about Butler. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she never denied that. It is discursive. That's the main point.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Farad, interestingly enough, she is a philosopher of consciousness. So she's not a kind of physicist practitioner. She's thinking, she's writing about this, so she's also braiding somehow into kind of a discourse on science.
I
but
think some of Butler's kind of being put as well on the on the apparatus, because this is one of the main issues, the fact that picture shaped through the apparatus that is used to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the apparatus you use to look at things not only look at things but creates them, shapes them, gives them a meaning. And so at your definition, which was quite witty and interesting, that is the egg or the chicken is actually it's not about it's the head of the chicken or the laying of the egg, but it's more
mm-hmm.
like the phenomenon could be about the chicken, could be about the egg. It is the way you look at it. So it's the egg, look at the chicken. The chicken is the mother. The chicken looks at the egg, or you look at the egg and you think it's my breakfast. Very important. Also, this differing in discourse is a big issue. I don't know if why that was the predecessor, and somehow you really, really point that out.
Yeah, but yeah, and she reworks this the concept of causality. And it's okay, what comes first, what comes second. And I feel like also something that is very affirmative, that is propositive, is to say, okay, well, let's not even think about words. Of things, let's think about already like a large systems. That funnily enough, her understanding of the large system as the unit, the basic unit, is also comes from quantum physics, come from kind of studying Niels Bohr, studying kind of very like the study of particles or something that is so particular, but that allows her to give us like. From the particular to develop something that is a more like a larger and complex system that becomes the very basic unit of even like thinking of like thinking ontology, and then means thinking of the rest, means thinking our understanding.
Which is efficacy in Whitehead.
Yeah, it's fine.
But I'm asking, like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know, because this lit is homage in a lot of ways. It just seems like there's like a lot of work that's somehow like left out of this. That it seems like maybe that would be really substantial and helpful.
What do you mean by reworking causality? Because I mean, causality also has been a theme like forever.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it seems like she's trying to just make a point that causality is what we are like. Somehow embedded in, but then I'm wondering what is there something else? Like, is she accounting for that, and how?
Yeah, not fair enough. I mean, unfortunately, as I said, I mean, I'm trying to do kind of reading of a particular thing that is agential realism. Then this agential realism goes in many different directions, which I've also like annoyed at Karen Barad Esker, so I'm kind of trying to work through certain things. that are of my particular interest, my specific interest in thinking this agential realism, and thinking of kind of you rethink question of kind of objectivity. What is objectivity? What makes something what is kind of, if we think in terms of kind of discursive rather than in terms of kind of words and language, which is kind of the practice that I come from. And also what I'm interested, the reason why I'm interested in kind of Bharat, so Bharat comes from a kind of feminist tradition of thinking question of embodiment and thinking question of relationality. And what I find interesting, what I appreciate, is that she kind of possibly playing with being kind of being presenting something that could be potentially like universal, but from a very kind of embodied perspective, and thinking through kind of this idea of interdependency, and thinking, rethinking also subjectivity, that is something that, for instance, I think in speculative realism, from what I understood, is left out. And I think in Bharat system, this could be inconceivable.
I don't think it's left out. It's rendered as another sense of objectivity.
Maybe we could just finish. No, it's super interesting. I just don't want to get off track, and then we can kind of move to the discussion later, because we're kind of getting off track and over this moving fast.
Yeah. But yeah, I think, I don't know, I think I had a few conversations with people say, okay, you know, we are not interested in kind of any question of subjectivity, at least not in the way like post, I don't know, humanist thinker are thinking about subjectivity and the relevance that they give to that particular kind of aspect. But I don't know, as I say, I haven't been reading anything of that. So I cannot say, I'm saying also I'm speaking from my experience of having conversation with people. But I feel like it's very, very, for me, like very, very interesting to see how like feminist theory can find also space in science through, obviously, I mean, Bharat, but Bharat also refers to Donna Haraway. So in a way, there is nothing new, not even, now we are going to look at the question of embodiment, and the question of embodiment, basically, Bharat's understanding of the body, Bharat's understanding of the body without contours comes from Donna Haraway.
Exactly, who is enormously influenced by Whitehead. So
yeah.
I was trying to get at this.
Okay,
whatever.
Yeah. Continue. Thanks. So, material and discursive factors are crucial to the process of materialization. In Meeting the Universal for Way, Bharat suggests that what is at issue is a differential material embodiment, not in the sense of conscious subjective experience of the individual human subject, but in terms of different material configurations of ontological bodies and boundaries. We have seen that phenomena and material discursive practices are boundary-making practices through which matter comes to matter, and phenomena produce other phenomena in this kind of ongoing dynamics of intra-activity. Phenomena are not mere product of human or social constructions, but humans are phenomena in themselves, and they are part of this process of ongoing mattering. Humans are of the world, Bharat suggests, not in the world, and surely not outside of it looking in. Humans and non-humans interact and participate in equal manner to the world's ongoing articulation, as Bharat calls it. And since we are part of the phenomena we assume to investigate, also, the understanding of what realism or objectivity is, according to Bharat, might need to be reworked. The realism of agential realism is the possibility to provide accurate, and here quoting Bharat, accurate descriptions of that reality of which we are a part and with which we interact, rather than some imagined and idealized human independent reality. However, there is always the risk of projecting upon nature romanticizing aspects of our experience of the reality we live in, putting our words into animal mouth, for instance. There is a risk of dismifying the world around us, which certainly shouldn't prevent us from understanding that there are no absolute boundaries between human beings and other species, between human bodies and other life forms. When Deleuze and Guattari in A Thousand Plato speak of becoming animal, the last thing they meant was that we should act as if we were animals, or that we can put our words into animals' mouth. One does not become an animal. Even if you spend like most of your time with a laptop, you will never become a laptop. But as they explain, becoming animal is a question of composing a body with the animal, a body defined by zone of proximities and intensities. Deleuze and Guattari explain that you do not become a barking mall or dog, but by barking, if it is done with enough feeling, with enough necessity and composition, you emit a molecular dog. You enter in a zone of proximity with the dog. In this way, Deleuze explained, we become molecular collectivities. We never become molar subject together, but we become molecular collectivity. Not assuming or imitating the animal, but entering in a zone of proximity. Ondine is a former biologist and fond of lobsters, carps, and clams. She goes to spas and practices special mud treatments to not be human anymore, or to create the zone of proximity that will eventually turn her into a new organism, an organism that is neither animal nor human, but both human and animal. She suspects that some submarine species, like lobsters, for instance, might be immortal, and she ponders the possibility of becoming lobsters as a way to open a path to become immortal. She is part of a couple of biologists and doctors who claim to have discovered the way to Atlantis. They study marine life in the hope to extract the secret of longevity from them. Through the performance of this special treatment with mud, Ondine hopes to reach the desired proximity with submarine life and possibly convert it into a new organism. Ondine is the protagonist of artist Louis Hebert and Chloé Mallet video Waterway.
On sait parce qu'on étudiait la coquille. D'abord, par les temps, on a tué une balance de 507 ans. Par les gars. Les carpes aussi peuvent vivre plus de 100 ans. On sait, en tout cas, pour les carpes japonaises, parce qu'elles vivent en captivité. On en connaît une qui est morte à 226 ans. Alors, le plus extraordinaire, le plus merveilleux, c'est qu'il y a des espèces parviennent à se régénérer. Elles sont capables d'inverser le processus en quelque sorte. Là, le petit krill est capable de revenir à l'état larvaire. Il y a des méduses, j'oubliais. Il y a des méduses, je ne suis pas sûre, qui peuvent enchaîner plusieurs cycles. Ça veut dire qu'elles vieillissent, elles rajeunissent, elles vieillissent à nouveau, et on ne sait pas combien de temps. Tu vois ce que je veux dire? Bon, là, évidemment, on ne pourra pas apporter ce caractère-là chez l'humain, ça ne marchera pas. C'est pas le même programme, ça n'aurait pas de sens. Notre humain est fait pour vivre. Enfin, il y aurait peut-être une solution. Ce serait de plus être humain, ce serait de se transformer radicalement.
Mais toi, tu crois qu'on peut vraiment changer? Tu crois que si je dis oui, je veux changer, je pourrais vraiment changer?
Ouais. terre avant, on avait les mains palmées. D'accord. C'est la mort des cellules, je veux dire le suicide cellulaire, qui fait qu'on commence à avoir des doigts. Quand t'es petit, oui, quand t'étais petit dans le ventre de ta mère, t'étais pas un humain. Et ça veut dire que il faudrait juste revenir en arrière. Tu viens de travailler avec nous.
C'est très intéressant.
The two artists, Louis Hebert and Chloé Mallet, problematize the common understanding of post-anthropocentric, post-humanist kind of bodies. And post-humanist theorists that understand that there is no, or that seems to suggest that there is no space for human beings, or where the desire to become other, translated to preposterous attempt to free ourselves from ourselves in an ultimate final dissolution of planet Earth. Waterway seems to point to an incommensurable difference. Ondine cannot become a lobster, even if she tries very hard with her mud treatments and all these researches. But she can empathize, she can become a molecular lobster, take on herself some of the qualities expressed by the lobster, and certainly, in so doing, she will be able to improve her existence. But how do bodies materialize in proximity as a molecular collectivities in a post-human fashion? And to follow up with Barat, how does matter make itself be felt? Barat reworks Butler's notion of performativity, but looking at the material dimension of regulatory apparatuses as a materiality of phenomenon, as kind of part of the phenomenon as material, and as phenomenon and apparatuses as boundary making practices which enhance or limit particular materialization. But while Butler's account of regulatory apparatuses seem to be focusing very much on the discursive dimension of bodily production, Barat's post-humanist agential realism suggests that all bodies, not merely human bodies, come to matter through the world's iterative intra-activity, which is its performativity. This is true not only of the surface or contours of the body, but of the body in its kind of full physicality, including his kind of atom, the constitutive of like the very, very small and invisible parts. Barat, following Arway, suggests that bodies are not objects with inherent boundaries and properties. They are material discursive phenomena. Human bodies, Barat suggests, are not inherently different from non-human. What constitutes the human and the non-human is not bits of a pre-given notion, nor is it a free-floating ideality. Barat also suggests that there is an abundance of empirical evidences, that visual clues are often misleading, and that bodies do not possess their own boundaries, for they are not static objects, Embodied boundaries are always constituted as a result of particular bodily engagements of the world. Bodies, like any other object or like phenomena, Barat suggests, are not already there. They don't stand in front of our eyes, but they emerge through specific practices, Barat suggests. There is no natural state of beings. There are bodies without clear contours. And those contours come to matter through specific practices, through phenomenal and discursive that are boundary-making practices. Karen Barat takes this idea of embodiment from Donna Haraway's notion of situatedness, in which Haraway suggests that bodies are never given, but bodies are always in the making, they are not made. They're bodies that are shaped by material and social practices. And also Haraway described the situatedness. She said bodies are nodes in a system, in a web of relation. The body without contours that Barat describes is tremendously fascinating. And it's actually, I think it's quite strong to think about this body without contours. But Barat, however, doesn't seem to offer any concrete example that hasn't been already in some ways discussed by Haraway in an account of the techno-bodies and the techno-materialities and this idea of the body in the making and not already made and body without kind of boundaries. But the idea of bodies without contours resonates with another thinker, Beatrice Preciado, with her idea of potentia gaudendi, which is the orgasmic force that Preciado suggests designates the real or virtual strength of the body's total excitation. Beatrice Preciado potentia gaudendi could be described as a queer form of materiality, if you want. This potentia gaudendi is the energy that propels us. Preciado said it doesn't have gender, it's neither feminine or masculine, human nor animal or non-human. It doesn't recognize a distinction between heterosexual and homosexual, between object and subject. It is the excitable potential of molecules and particles, of bodies, animals and things. According to Preciado, potentia gaudendi has been put to work by advanced capitalism, in which pleasure seems to have become a form of capital. But still, also Preciado take on potentia gaudendi, or this kind of, which almost makes me think of the body without contours, it's anyway very problematic. And also, Preciado is kind of never clear, as it feels like also Barat is kind of seduced by this idea of the body without contours, but then it doesn't move, where does it go? How does this change the idea of embodiment, of a post-humanist kind of form of embodiment? And Preciado, potentia gaudendi, is also very, she suggests that, oh, it is abstract, but it's also very material, and is everywhere. So all this description, I found this description of embodiment, of form of embodiment, of the body without contour, or the potentia gaudendi that is kind of propels the body, very, very abstract. And don't necessarily give me any clue about the idea of post-gender bodies or post-humanist body. So also the idea of the entanglement, I can follow Barat when she talks about agential realism and how everything somehow is kind of in this process of kind of mattering, is all entangled. But when it comes to her account of embodiment and this kind of post-humanist, agential realist account of how matter comes to matter, it seems the body remains a kind of this strange, nothing is really clear, nothing is really kind of explained. And I also don't see how this can be so different than Donna Haraway's description of the expanded body. So the question is, the body without contour, potential gaudens in super abstract. So are we talking about like the post-humanist body, post-gender body? Is it a body like where the boundaries dissolve? Is it the kind of dissolution that Scarlett Johansson goes through in Luc Besson's movie Lucy? When Lucy Brain's capacity are finally fully enhanced, she starts jumping from one place, like electrons, from one place to the other, from past, future, while her body is slowly liquefying to finally recompose in the shape of a black USB stick that contains all the knowledge of the world. You see the USB stick? I couldn't find a better image. But, yeah, because the problem with also this idea of the potentia gaudendi, or the body without contours, don't necessarily seem to suggest any other kind of scenario, because they seem so, like, too, okay, so, like, abstract, so kind of open, this moment of open, the body that is open. And seem to suggest this type of kind of final dissolution of the body into some kind of into numbers, into the USB stick, into technology. But is this the scenario that a body without contour, that a post-humanist body present us with? Does Freud's body without contours, as Deleuze's idea of becoming animal, or Preciado potenzi gaudendi, really suggest such a scenario where the boundaries between human and non-human entirely disappear? No. Or at least I would argue no. Because I see a link between post-humanism and feminist practices of sexual difference. Because while it seems to me that both Barat and Preciado are trying to maneuver themselves out of the impasse of a discussion on gender and sexuality, and especially of sexual difference, however, much of their thinking is in debt to French feminist philosophy of sexual difference, because when Barat, what I found also interesting in Barat, is this idea of this process, continuous process of differing, which in concept that as a fundamental in any discussion of kind of French feminists of the 70s, the French sexual difference, which has been discharged, especially in the United States. American feminism, especially in the 70s, was totally like against kind of French feminism because it was all about equality, and for French was all about difference.
Except for all the speculative realists that are talking about Lucy regarding.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
My point. I'm coming back.
Yeah. But she might come in from the, probably, absolutely from that tradition,
sure.
Which is new to me as a reader of Karen Barat. It's new to me.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you come and you have that formation, that probably makes sense for you. You have all the elements.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about that. But I found like very important to stress this. How these thinkers among both Preciado and Barat adopt this idea of difference, which in French feminism is not only a difference between women and men, but it's the acknowledgement of difference in general, of any difference. At least how I understand sexual politics of sexual difference, they're about accounting for the ways in which we experience the world differently, that is, in the specificity of one's own embodied experience, which also is a big problem, because we are faced with a paradox, because how can you just look from your own small perspective and very limited perspective and kind of trying to account for kind of collectivity or collective form of actions? This is the big paradox, I feel, that has remained unsolved in much of feminist theories of embodiment. or do we come for a general experience or for kind of a more universalist way of thinking while being still loyal to the kind of the specificity of one's own experience as a situated body, as a situated subjectivity. Barat bodies without inherent boundaries are bodies constituted in a process of differential becoming, and Barat stressed this idea of differential, of differing. That is through a process that acknowledges difference as the very possibility of existence and of transformation of and becoming. It is through the production of difference, indeed, that this through the process of differing, that matter comes to matter and bodies become meaningful.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm lonely without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them.
She's dealing in a kind of trajectory that I'm very interested in, that type of way of thinking that I'm very interested in, that's been going on for a while, but she seems to be clearly dealing with feminism in an interesting
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how she's doing, because I don't see what she's adding to the conversation yet. And that's where I'm really curious. What is she affirming? Because, okay, she's rehashing some of the stuff that Haraway said. She's, like, dealing clearly, heavily with Whitehead.
Yeah.
And, but then I'm like, where is it going? Like, what are you saying about that that hasn't, I don't know.
Can you give me a definition of a affirmative? What do you understand as a affirmative?
Like, a production of novelty.
No, exactly. This is exactly what feminism, practice of affirmative, is not necessary about.
We're talking about reworking.
Transformation. Okay, for me it's a different phrase.
Which means that you are not necessarily producing anything new, but you are reworking something. For instance, like, I never have seen anybody dealing till today with sexual difference as kind of somehow Karen Barat is trying to do. Yes, it's all Preciado. Preciado comes from a particular kind of field, political, engaged, also coming from the humanities. But the first time that I see someone that comes from science and that says, okay, well, this process of difference, what everything that sounded so like like vague and so like about subjectivity and how you experience being woman or being different. These actually are all things that we find in science, that in science that science also helps to understand that this difference, the quantum theory, the fact that it's all about potentiality, but potentiality are real. And she said, okay, we go through in quantum physics and you can see this.
Yeah.
And I think this is what it's not necessarily probably about producing something new, but already the fact that this person, this thinker, is bringing all this thing together for me is already extraordinary. It doesn't have to be new.
It's not that it's new, you're misunderstanding the way I'm using novelty because I'm referring directly to Whitehead with that.
Yeah.
He is about the fact that if everything is a constitution of its relations and a nexus of the different comprehensions of those things, every particularity is necessarily a novelty. So any sort of transformation or possible hybrid in the Haraway-ian sense or Latourian sense is going to be something that is new. And because it's new, it is a novelty. That's what I mean to refer to. So in that sense, like, what is she, like, how is her hybridization of all of these ideas affirming some sort of sense of beauty? Because I think this is a really fertile strain, particularly in the way that you are discussing that. And I know Isabel Schwenger is working with this really deeply and talking about, like, field research in the context of gender and, like, what that could be. And she's dealing with these contour problems, for instance, that you were discussing. But, like, I still can't get at the kernel of this woman's work.
Can I ask a question from a really nice, ignorant position? Like, if this person with this writer you're talking about is with Whitehead, what colour would they be versus the colour of Catherine Barad? Is it a question about tone rather than content?
I think it's just about history, because he wrote this, a lot of his work around the 1920s.
But if you had to describe him as a colour or a sensibility, what colour would he be?
It sounds like you're trying to get me into an identitarian trap.
I think I'm also trying to figure out that this is clear. This is what I start saying. You know, I think this is really good. This is really interesting, and I want to share with you. But I don't have. I'm not a Barad scholar. I get for me this like the talk is also a way of getting into something. I also don't. I also have the same question.
I'm not asking for answers. I'm just like, where can we go from?
Exactly. But I feel like I come maybe more from kind of discursive, like in gender and feminism, and I think like when I see Archie's kind of like working through Butler and the idea of performativity and also kind of going against Butler and say, okay, but Butler actually doesn't necessarily account for materiality, but also for me it's not really clear how she is kind of overcoming this problem of the relation between the material, the discursive in concrete terms, and I don't see how she is going beyond Judith Butler, because then I realized that she's using a lot of Butler.
Yeah, because I think it's a problem subjectivity, personally.
Well, I think I have a question that may help link and put it in a slightly different frame rather than saying, okay, so what's new with that? Because we can say that about almost any thinker, right? Because I'm not trying to be antagonistic or anything. I'm just saying, like, we could almost apply that similar question. Like, so what's new in Benji? What's really new? I thought we could kind of apply that. So, like, my question specific to the talk, without bringing in too many other thinkers that people may not be aware of, is in this boundary-making practices, you said, like, one of her tenets, just to stick with her text, was to always be aware of the remainder, because the boundary does produce an outside.
Yep.
So there's like one aspect of that I think is quite interesting, which I think could bring it into this definition of affirmation, would be that, especially in the art world, it's kind of like riddled with critique, it's going nowhere, it's just a kind of, it's a mode of identification of something rather than actually moving on to that particularity or that novelty, however you want to term it. So what it does mean, and caught in that regime of critique, is also this kind of disavowal of a possibility of an outside, right? That's like a kind of thing we always hear over and over, there's no outside of the system, blah, blah, blah. So it seems like in invoking a boundary-making practice, then you are also responsible, you create an outside. Because you are creating remainders, you're creating exclusions every time you constitute a boundary.
Yeah.
So the question is there any explanation, and again, I know you're not a moral expert, I don't expect you to be, but is there any element of the text that starts to talk about maybe the lumen terms, re-entry of those outs, constitutive outsides, something like that, where to me that would be more of a definition of a complex system that you invoked earlier, rather than saying, like, okay, we're just kind of constantly making boundaries, until those subsystems would start to then have interrelations relations or modes of entanglement. That to me is where the complexity is. But I'm just basically, the simple question is, does she account for, besides just acknowledging the creation of a remainder, of an exception, of that which lies beyond the system, does she account for that recursively coming in into a series of interactions, which for me would also be like the Latourian moment, but
the thing is, it's always already, at least how I understand Barat, it's always interactivity. It's not that there is a moment of interactivity and there is a moment of non-interactivity. So, in a way, these boundaries are always reconfigured. So, the moment that I bring something, that I bring an idea, that we, this is how I understand Barat, is that the moment that I bring something with me, or physically, or an idea, I'm already reconfiguring the boundaries that exist. So it's this constant, and that's why she talks about interactivity, because nothing exists outside this continuous interactivity and continuous reconfiguration. So it's more, it seems to me that it's more about, it's all, I think it's, in this sense she's very, very close to Derrida, understanding of like the meaning that is in language, where there is a meaning that is always there, and it's more, and sometimes you pick one specific meaning from a concept, but then the other meanings are always already there, and you account for them, and you keep them always as part of your investigation, so never giving, basically the idea is never giving anything for granted.
In terms of openings, maybe I think one short comment and then a question to the middle part of the talk. I mean, in terms of openings, it is a way out of, on the one hand, let's say a positivist common sense where people want to, you know, what you see is what you get. Obviously, if you've got clear materialities, you never get what you get. And as well as a way out of, let's say, discursive determinism or discursive monism, that at least I've been raised on in my cultural studies, where, I don't know, this was it all, it's an exclusive condition, there's no outside, no. And then, I think that's already fascinating. Yeah. And then when it comes to going beyond that with someone like Niels Bohr and bringing back, which might, something that might be common sense in physics, this notion of relationality, then to activate that center of relationality as you've done in the middle parts, so ideas of touching and luminescence and all these kind of strange phenomena, I think there's some quality there which activates it in a way that goes beyond, let's say, the universal question, but what is the world made of? But it's like, how do we activate it? And I think by going into art, I think we went a long way into showing these activations where suddenly another language comes in, which no longer just that of the scientist saying, but what is it? You know? But it's where this thing really starts happening in a different way.
Yeah, but to go back to your now the question about this boundary making, which is, I think, it's very, very important, because it immediately says something about, okay, well, how do we under, that's why I was bringing Derrida. So sometimes there's like, we give for granted some kind of concepts, and we think that this is the way it is, and we start from there. And basically, the way I understand Barat is to say, okay, just remember that this is like is performed in a particular time, in a particular moment and way, and has been given a particular cut. But doesn't mean that within that concept, within that idea, there are also other possibilities that are there. So that's why I think she then say, okay, I want to rework idea of kind of discursive practices and bring in this Bohr, Niels Bohr, and Foucault and Butler together. I want to rework the idea of performativity. What is performativity? What is a performative methodology? And in a way, I think this is precisely this kind of cut, this kind of understanding that, acknowledging that there are always kind of boundaries that we create through phenomena, through discourse, but that can be. No, that can be constantly kind of reconfigured, basically.
I was wondering, because that's also maybe a response, because you were asking how can you do that? So in terms of this kind of, you know, brand remaking, and when you're asking the question, how can you do that, I think then it becomes again a very important one, like, of like how, what's really happening in this brand remaking. And I mean, I was reading Zizek, and you made a comment like on Sunday, kind of him being to universalist or something, but I thought there were some interesting ideas on, you know, the ways of how, what happens, like, with the particles, right? And
yes.
What precisely makes the particles move in a certain way, or what's actually happening? And I mean, Mladen Dollar was talking about it in terms of the Kleinerman and all this kind of concepts bringing in and speaking about the void and you know, something and how that comes together and continuously and so on. And I think looking at that, I mean, I've also just encountered that he's actually also commenting on Dollar and the causality kind of things. And I thought it was still interesting because that gives you another maybe idea of how can you actually act upon it, like, or how can you use that? You know, I mean, this becomes probably a little bit too meta or something. But if you really want to tackle that question, I think that's a worth looking at in a way, and also of course.
But wouldn't that not just discourse?
I'm sorry.
Wouldn't that be just discourse? If you look at it from that way, like, because the question is like how. I mean, this whole thing of relation and this constant movement of entanglement and everything. I mean, I also ask myself the question of where is the doing, where is the action, I mean, where the action comes from.
Yeah, but
if it is then, like, this problems or these atoms that jump around and to actually engage in it, then I don't really see the big difference with just creating discourse.
Because it's not only our mind, it's happening whether we're thinking about it or not. And this is precisely to bring decisive lines through it. The reason I have such frustration to bring up the history of philosophy is that precisely about the dominance of discourses and where post-structuralism and these discourses have become overly totalitarian in intellectual and philosophical circles. And people don't think about how there's been people doing this kind of work for a very long time and marginalize them, similarly to how women have been marginalized in various discourses. So it's kind of ironic, because it performs the very process of that sort of marginalization in this process of the history of philosophy, where there's like this Kantian specter, and everyone's trying to reconcile it by talking about Foucault, talking about Judith Butler, but there is like a whole other trajectory that is decisively cut from that, and I think it's worth acknowledging that, and seeing like where that interplay is, and maybe like exploring those lines.
But as a science and outside and the acting as well, I think with her example of what is light, a particle or a wave, there are only kind of two options. And both of them, when you actually acted and did the experiments, didn't make sense. So there had to be some kind of other thing. It's a particle that acts like a wave, so it's not really both. And then it created actually a new science out of it. So somehow a new, also a new discourse, but also a new materiality that comes into being out of the outside that was not there before. You ask the questions, you mark the boundaries, there are only two things in the world, wave and particles, and what is light? and done it. So there's an action there.
But also this idea of that, I mean, unfortunately I didn't also, I wanted to play a sound piece by Ruth Buchanan, amazing artist, and I think like what I wanted to do by bringing the artistic practices, and maybe I could have insisted more on the artistic practices, is precisely to say these are doing that art, like that Barad is describing, is discussing us this kind of idea of entanglement as a doing. For me, like a lot of artists like Ruth Buchanan, or artists like Susanne Winterling, the French duo, these are all artists who work with complexity, and they ask, we have seen it in Barad, but they make a practice of this complexity and of this entanglement, what it means to be entangled, what it means to this entanglement of the material and matter. And I think they do it in the work. And so in this sense, for me, it was a way to say, okay, maybe we can think about Barad, or we can look and think Barad ideas that sound so abstract, but actually they have a reality. And not because, I mean, it's also very tricky because the moment that you bring philosopher and artist, it's like as if you were kind of trying to justify the artistic practices, or the artistic practices becoming kind of some sort of illustration of a kind of philosophical idea. But in this case, I see in this Barad idea of a doing, of the entanglement as a doing, is something that is not given, that there is no kind of object, but it's all phenomena I see happening in artistic practices a lot. That's why at the beginning I say it resonates for me a lot with artistic practices, especially today, where I feel artists struggle with this, okay, what should I do? Should I go for research-based practice and write the PhD and then go totally for the discursive, or no, I should go totally against the discursive and just engage and just make sculpture? And I feel like with Barad, you have someone who say, well, you know, these two things are together. And I feel, at least for me, such a big relief, because I feel like, yeah, exactly. I don't want to struggle either for like join the discursive or join people who just make and don't want to even listen to discursive practices. And especially not today, where discursive practices has such an, you know, as an important role. We all go to talk, we all read, we all do these things. And I feel like Barad somehow give us something very interesting to think about. To say, no, but think that practices are always material discursive, which might be the most kind of banal thing, but I found really great that someone say that. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit suspicious about this whole, about this continuation of these relations, and especially I mean, something that hasn't been touched in the talk, which
yeah.
I'm trying to reach, change the question of responsibility.
Yeah, true.
And so that's of course a whole different thing, but I would have liked to see them in there because it's not so much that it's too abstract or something,
no,
but it's.
Yeah, the question of accountability. Oh, you make yourself accountable.
Yeah, if you make it borderless and you relate everything to phenomena, then it's a bit easy thing. You can just relax. Everything happens.
How does, always my question was like, how does decision function?
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to kind of not strip the agency, but not put it in this kind of definitive role it has in a lot of, say, other theories, then my major question would always be, yeah, like, so how does one do politics in that? But that's it.
Yeah, no, there is actually part of the book, the Meeting the Universe of the Way, which is a 600 pages book, in a part in which Barad goes into political theory and discuss about that.
Like
that
the consequences of like
political
action.
The kind of political action and
so
political subject.
Book.
And I think so. I mean, it's a big book. And it's made of very different parts and many things.
Yeah.
But definitely, like the question of responsibility, which is the question of, is an ethical question.
Mm-hmm.
This goes throughout the book and throughout this idea of agential realism, this relational ontology. This idea, okay, make understanding that there are no entities that can stand by themselves. And then from time to time, that if they want, they get in touch with each other. But it's this idea of dependency, so you have to care. And that's why I was kind of trying, in a way, to touch upon that question of responsibility with the idea of touching.
Mm-hmm.
When touching is affecting, it has consequences.
How does she then account for, you know, if you like saying, okay, the dependency kind of, you know, requires kind of ethics of caring for, you know, everything or everything you embedded within, kind of, how does that then, how does it relate to, like, some idea of agency? Because she obviously, like, you know, emphasizes causality,
yeah.
Which I'm wondering how, like, is she somehow giving any account of, like, intentionality or agency? What is her understanding? Because to me, it's like, her notion of agency is kind of boiled down to causality. Is there any moment where she, you know?
Yeah, she discussed about this idea of agency, and but at least in the section that I have been kind of working and reading through, it's more about, okay, saying that we don't own it, as I said before, we don't own it, because our agency is always a doing. And I think it's more about, like, getting out of this idea of, like, agency as a human thing, where you would say, okay, I have agency as a human being that can decide to do this and that, and she said, no, everything has agency.
Okay, then does it enable then an ethics, if you do not have agency and doing is agency, is there then still an ethics, or is it then something that, what defines ethics, like, in relation to that mere doing?
Yeah, but then we open an entire kind of discussion that could go on and on, right, on ethics. But what I understood, definitely, I think she, at least this is not never stated, but I see, and that's why I was bringing also the Leslie Wattari or someone like Beatrice Pissarro, who have a vitalistic Spinozian approach to ethics. So definitely, I think she's, if you want, in that league.
But thinking about kind of what openings it does produce,
yeah.
Like, I find it totally thrilling how you were describing, how she embraces this idea of the phenomenon, no? Because one non-ethical position could be the othering of the phenomenon, the fetishization of this phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
that happens in the society of the spectacle,
yeah.
Where the phenomenon is always someone else's problem, and we
yeah.
sit back and look at it, no?
Yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, can you please take your clothes off, right? I'm looking at this, you're the phenomenon, you're hysterical. You are
yeah.
in the arena burn. So let's just say, like, the phenomenon is not out there, you are in the phenomenon.
Yeah.
And that means, like, this othering of the thing that is already interrupted. And on the other hand, also this kind of, like, I say, the arrogance of goodwill.
Yeah.
To say, like, it's about my moral decision because I'm so great, as opposed to you, who just made the wrong decision. Then to say, like, if the doing entangles us in the world, it also undercuts any kind of moral high ground where you install super egos or ideal egos. Instead, like, if it's happening at all, it happening from within the phenomenon, and that.
Yeah, I mean, you are not looking in. This is what she's saying. No, you are not looking in. Well, but because her entire, also, I think everything starts from kind of a critique of representationalism in science, and that from there she developed this kind of more this idea of agential realism and being part, and she reborn by kind of trying to oppose this idea of representationalism or representation that mediates our kind of relation to reality And yeah, she tried to shatter that and say, look, this is like, this is not how reality works. And then from there she goes into Niels Bohr and his understanding of the phenomenon and you as a part of the phenomenon. Which doesn't mean, which is also nice, and maybe you know a little bit more about that, because that you're okay, but doesn't mean that if you are in, there is no possible objectivity. Which I also find, because I think generally some theorists tend to then...
What does objectivity mean? It's that which is an object, other than that which is a subject. I think often we kind of conflate that idea in being a certain kind of idea in positive science that has to do with this idea that we can stand away from something. But it's really the matter that you can have an object to look at. And that's a series of objects. In the whole like history of like science studies and everything, they talk a lot about this. There's like a possibility that like a reframing of that, that it's often in science not understood the way we think of objectivity,
mm-hmm.
but it gets played like that. So
mm-hmm.
in fact, it's us on the philosophy end that kind of did a poor job of the representation. That objectivity in science, and especially a sort of embedded empiricism,
mm-hmm.
is one of a series of objects and investigating objects, because you can only investigate an object because you can't look at it, look at something that's not an object. If it doesn't have a body, you can't look at it, or you can't perceive it.
But it's not true. I mean, with the example of bioluminescence, if you don't provoke the bioluminescence, you don't see it.
Yeah, but the bioluminescence exists somewhere. It has a materiality, and it may take the provocation.
But it's funny, because Karen Barat is saying exactly, no, the thing, so it's not that it doesn't exist. It doesn't, at least how I understand it, it doesn't exist somewhere. It exists in the moment of...
But isn't that an affect or an element of, like, it's something that that material does when provoked a certain way, rather than the material itself?
Yeah, but what is it? But she's also a quantum like field theorist, so
yeah.
I bet
yeah.
she's like evoking the whole like quantum measurement, you know, phenomenon where nothing exists until you actually halt
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So I'm sure she's
yeah.
like throwing. I mean,
yeah.
I'm very skeptical about passing that universe on, like
yeah, but this is
biological reality. But you know, I'm sure that she's. I'm just trying to like try to understand from her perspective that I'm sure she's launching, casting that metaphor on.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's actually a fair assessment of quantum theory either, though, because it's not that things don't exist until we look at them. It's rather that they exist in the state in which they are perceived, their particular materiality
exactly.
is a function of how we
yeah.
perceive. But
yeah.
that does not negate the fact that they are there whether we perceive them or not. And
yeah.
that's really important in quantum physics. And actually, Isabel
yeah.
Stengers has a whole book on quantum
yeah.
politics
yeah.
about Niels Bohr and about this particular problem and the problem of how that's kind of been articulated in these really strange ways. That it's not about this, like, often, you know, quantum theory, like, oh, wow, it doesn't exist until we see it. Oh, it's like, no, science is much more materialistic than that.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Yeah, but it seems that it has a material because it's always in this, like it's one kind of materiality, as you say. But the moment that something then has a bioluminescent manifests itself, then you have also a different materiality than the materiality that was before. That you have a difference. That's why I think this process of differing that is basically matter is always there, but in the process of interactivity, that it keeps becoming matter, it keeps differing, it keeps changing his composition.
To some degree, but I would say if you think about bioluminescent bacteria, when they have certain stimuli, when they have certain stimuli, they reflect the light.
Yeah.
And when they're not given that stimuli, they're still there. They still exist materially, but they just give a different affect into the world.
I think we are saying more or less the same thing.
No, but I think it's important to say that it's still materially functioning.
Absolutely.
The way it touches us is different.
Yeah.
But that it still exists.
It exists in a particular form.
Slightly back in the discussion, back before something, the point that we reached before, no? Because, like, if I understood you right, this is thinking that tries to get away from, as you were saying, defining primacy, like chicken or egg.
What is it? Also, I 1 million retarded discussions about Judith Butler. Yeah, what is then not the primacy of the body onto which the discourses act? Must there not be something primary? She's kind of saying like there is no such thing as primacy.
No, because it's not beginning.
Yeah, yeah, but there has to be materiality. It has to exist first.
Because I'm not
primacy. But I think she doesn't think. I think she thinks about materiality, but she doesn't think in the first and second. She doesn't think there is, because it's this constant process of reconfiguring. So where there is not, there is never an origin, never up from the beginning.
No, definitely not, but it still has to exist, period. And that's why it's a realism. Like especially if she's approaching from science, it did have to exist in order to emanate those sorts of things.
Okay, to put it really simply then, just existing is doing.
Yeah,
totally.
Okay, so it didn't mean that for existence is doing. But
can I
I think what's more interesting, like, you know, what it's taken me a while to locate, you know, what it is that's going on here. But, you know, it's a little bit like this problem of magnitude and multitude, like, what constitutes the number one, you know? And maybe, you know, I think contemporary science isn't a place where it's neither magnitude or multitude, it's the same problem. So the idea is one, if one represents the entire universe as like a giant consistent thing, then our knowledge is about cutting it into little pieces, but we put it back together as one giant machine.
Yeah, but that's the
and then there's can you just wait? And then there's the other idea, which is monatomic theory. The one is little singular elements that come together to make up the whole that we perceive. So it's a different set of unity of a group of like items that produce all of the phenomena that we see. So you have one thing is like a big piece of cake that you're cutting up, and the other is like a school of fish.
Yeah, but science would demonstrate that neither of those are the case.
That's what I'm saying. So at one time we believed one thing, and we had this argument between two poles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reality. That was tangential reality for, exactly as you're saying, the ancient Greeks, etc., etc. Over time, it gets articulated differently and differently. This is when it becomes matter. This is all she's saying. The more dense that we articulate whatever the fuck it is we're trying to articulate, it's getting more matter.
Yeah.
And it's actually getting, in some ways, it's getting more difficult to understand.
What? Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to step in and suggest that I want to give you a very big round of applause. Just, I feel like it's somehow getting more private and intimate.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
People that want to go home, it's like Tuesdays or, you know, whatever.
Oh,
or
people have a different question.
All good, but I just don't want, like, people to feel like, yeah,
yeah,
it seems
it's
to me like there's, like, a more intimate discussion happening, and I don't want to feel everyone, like, has to say or whatever. But I want to thank you very much for your endurance, and thank you very much for your questions. And
thank you for
coming. Yeah, hopefully see you again in January. But, yeah, thank you, Federica. Yeah.
Thank you.